It's Philosophy Talk.
There have always been conspiracy theories. The moon landings were fake.
Every single bird in the sky is a robot.
Rampant voter fraud that allowed Democrats to literally steal the election.
Why are some people susceptible to conspiracy theories?
Who doesn't have a few weird beliefs?
Some have claimed that suburban women revolted against the Republican Party, but doesn't it feel more true that all Hispanics voted twice?
Are conspiracy theorists irrational, or are they just victims of misinformation?
There was a huge increase in what people call stacking, where multiple children will stack on top of each other under a trench coat and then vote as an adult.
Isn't it healthy to question the received narrative?
It's not easy. You have to learn to live with uncertainty.
Our guest is Christopher French from the University of London.
Thinking like a conspiracy theorist.
It's not paranoia if they're really out to get you.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey there, philosopher. Just taking a moment to thank you for being a listener.
And asking you to please consider making an end-of-year gift to support the program, so that we can continue to question everything.
Except your intelligence. This past year, it's been everything from rage to robots, from Marcus to memoir.
So head over to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click the Support Us button at the top of the page.
Or give the gift of thought to the other philosophers in your life with a subscription to our library of more than 500 episodes.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
Is the media lying to us all the time?
Isn't it paranoid to think we're controlled by unseen forces?
What does it mean to do your own research?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs.
And I'm Blakey Vermeul, sitting in for Josh Landy. We're coming to you via the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy, and Blakey teaches in the Philosophy and Literature program. Thanks again for helping out, Blakey.
My pleasure. Today we're asking what it's like to think like a conspiracy theorist.
Ugh, I would never want to think like a conspiracy theorist. Their thoughts are riddled with errors. They ignore contrary evidence if it doesn't fit with what they already believe. They think they're experts on things they know nothing about. And they project malicious intent onto events that have perfectly innocent explanations.
But we all make mistakes in our thinking. Psychologists tell us that everybody is susceptible to cognitive biases. And if you think you're immune, then that makes you even more susceptible.
Wait. You're saying there's no difference between me and the person in a tinfoil hat who's making endless internet posts about how the Earth is flat and how we're secretly being ruled by lizard people?
Look, not all conspiracy theories are so far-fetched. A lot of them are a matter of historical record. Government health organizations deliberately infected poor rural black men in Tuskegee with syphilis as part of a medical experiment. The NSA paid internet companies tens of billions of dollars to spy on ordinary Americans. And if you tried to talk about any of that at the time, your friends would have handed you a tinfoil hat. But it was all true.
Okay, fine. Sometimes the government and corporations lie to us. But a lot of conspiracy theories go way beyond that observation. People think that there's one global conspiracy that explains everything, from scientific predictions about climate change, to the economy, to the war in Ukraine. They're not carefully weighing the evidence at all.
But how are ordinary people supposed to weigh evidence these days? The internet is a fire hose of bad information, and it all sounds plausible. There's just too much to audit everything.
Okay, yeah, there's a lot of information, but you have to take some personal responsibility for your beliefs. Whatever happened to basic critical thinking or checking for obvious mistakes? A lot of people don't even bother.
Critical thinking is great, but it's also extremely hard to do when you're surrounded by companies that are competing for your attention and trying to make you click on things out of fear and outrage. It's like trying to stay on the wagon when all of your friends are big drinkers.
Well, if your sources of information are bad, you should just seek out better ones. You know, get your news from somewhere reputable instead of InfoWars or something.
How do you tell which news outlets are reputable? It seems like you'd need some independent way of knowing whether they're lying to you, but they're your source of information about the news.
Yeah, you can't know for certain, but you should still try to do something. You know, fact-check articles before you share them. See if they're published by a source with its own fact-checking standards. Don't look at sources with a strong partisan bias.
That's great as far as it goes, but no amount of legitimacy is enough to guarantee that someone is trustworthy, especially someone with enough power to be shaping the news in the first place. The world is run by oligarchs, and we are being lied to all the time. Disinformation is the fifth horseman of the apocalypse.
Whoa, Blakey, you know, you're kind of starting to sound like a conspiracy theorist yourself.
Okay, but I do believe that all of us can be conspiracy theorists under the right circumstances.
You really think I could be a conspiracy theorist? But I'm really careful. I follow my evidence where it leads. What are the circumstances that would do that to me?
Under circumstances of chaos, oppression, deceptive authorities, and bad evidence, you might question whether what you're being told is really the truth.
Okay, yeah, I see how in those circumstances, I really would have to question everything, including journalism and science. But luckily, I'm not in those circumstances now.
Can you really be so sure? The problem with conspiracy thinking is that it is very easy to detect in your political opponents, but almost impossible to detect in yourself or in your group.
You know, I bet our guest will have something to say about that. It's Christopher French, co-author of Anomalistic Psychology, Exploring Paranormal Belief and Experience.
I'm really looking forward to talking to him. But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Sarah Lye Sterland, to investigate conspiracy thinking around voting and elections. She files this report.
If you follow the 2022 midterm elections, you probably heard about confrontations at ballot boxes in Arizona.
Two men, armed, wearing tactical gear, watching voters. According to complaints filed and referred to the Department of Justice last week, one voter complained he was called a mule.
That was a reference to a movie called 2000 Mules that came out in May.
What is a mule?
Person picking up ballots and running them to the drop boxes.
Here's the movie's central premise. Left-leaning groups cheat in elections by collecting and delivering thousands of votes with forged signatures to ballot boxes in swing states. The movie uses geo-tracking data from cell phones and video footage in five swing states to make its claims. But election experts and technologists have rejected the movie's deceptive narrative. Multiple news organizations report that the data in 2000 Mules just doesn't add up. Even Bill Barr, the former Attorney General under President Trump, thinks this narrative is misleading, as he told the January 6th committee.
My opinion then and my opinion now is that the election was not stolen by fraud. I haven't seen anything since the election that changes my mind on that, including the 2000 Mules movie.
Nevertheless, conservative politicians and activists across the country seized on the movie's claims. They mobilized supporters to monitor ballot boxes to stop the alleged activity.
People have been organizing to try to watch drop boxes to prevent these so-called mules from dropping off ballots when the reality is there's not really evidence to support that that is a widespread phenomenon.
Stephen Prochaska is a PhD student at the University of Washington. He's part of a group called the Election Integrity Partnership, and he studies how groups amplify conspiracy theories and disinformation online.
People are not just like passively receiving this information, they're collaborating in both making it and then acting on it.
Digital and social media, he notes, enables activists to embellish the inflammatory narrative.
One of the things that does make the modern context a little bit different is the way that these platforms can provide a literal platform for conspiracy theorizing. It also allows for manipulation and in a much more direct way than previously had been easily available.
Multiple articles have documented flaws in the US voting system, which leads to the question, In a complex world, just how are we supposed to quickly tell when something is a harmful conspiracy theory and when it's not?
One of the reasons conspiracy theories are dangerous is they're so close to genuine rational belief.
T. Nguyen is a professor of philosophy at the University of Utah. He studies online communities, trust, and influence, and how influencers can manipulate that trust.
Actual reality involves this careful management of who to trust, but involves substantial trust.
He notes that conspiracy theorists trust only a select group of people, and they find reasons to distrust institutional sources of information.
Conspiracy theories restore us to the idyllic world where we get to think for ourselves and make things clear and explain everything within our grasp.
It's rigged.
Bloomberg News found that conservative candidates routinely saw much higher social media engagement from election conspiracy posts than from any other kinds of posts. What these rigged election candidates didn't say was that all the claims in 2000 Mules had been debunked.
Often conspiracy theories are what we would call dangerous speech.
Word choice and choosing when to speak out is important too, says Susan Benesch, founder of the Dangerous Speech Project. That's a group of researchers who study the typical kinds of speech patterns and contexts that precede mass violence.
When they serve to teach people to regard another group of people as a mortal threat.
Benesch says that when that happens, it gives individuals a justification to attack. That's what we hear in 2000 Mules.
They have ruined Election Day in the United States of America. That's provable. And that's enough for me to fight the left with every fiber in my body.
Still, in 2022, voters rejected the conspiracy theorists. And Benesch says that's significant.
The results of the midterms present a rare opportunity in the sense that they have convinced significant numbers of Republican leaders that dangerous lies are no longer a good way to get elected, but they need to be pressured to speak out publicly.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Sarah Lye-Sterland.
Thanks for that fascinating report, Sarah. I'm Ray Briggs, and with me is my Stanford colleague, Blakey Vermeule, sitting in for our usual co-host, Josh Landy. And today, we're thinking like a conspiracy theorist.
We are joined now by Christopher French. He's Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Goldsmiths College at the University of London and co-author of Anomalistic Psychology, Exploring Paranormal Belief and Experience. Christopher, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So, Chris, you write about conspiracy thinking. But what first got you interested in that topic? Do you have one of those ranting relatives who likes to spout nonsense around the holiday table?
I'm afraid I don't, actually. No. My interest in, if you like, kind of weird beliefs, or at least what I perceive to be weird beliefs, goes back quite some time. I mean, when I was younger, when I was a teenager and even into early adulthood, I actually believed quite a lot of paranormal stuff. And it was actually when I was doing my PhD in a completely different area, somebody recommended a particular book that they thought I'd like. It was called Parapsychology, Science or Magic. It was by a psychologist called James Alcock. And it was the first kind of skeptical treatment of all this stuff that I'd ever come across. And I really did like it and find it very compelling. And then what started off as a hobby actually became a bit more of a serious research interest until basically that became what I was known for. And it was a few years back that I took on a PhD student, a very bright PhD student by the name of Rob Brotherton. And he wanted to study the psychology of belief in conspiracies. And that's what really got me much more interested in the whole area. And of course, a lot of conspiracy theories, not all by any means, but some of them do involve a paranormal component. And a lot of the psychological factors that underlie belief in conspiracies are also relevant to belief in the paranormal. So, you know, there's a lot going on there.
Chris, we've talked a lot about whether it's rational to believe a conspiracy theory, but we've never really defined what exactly a conspiracy theory is. How would you define it?
It's incredibly, it's one of those very slippery concepts that on the surface, we all think we know what a conspiracy theory is. When you dig a little bit deeper, you realize it's actually quite tricky. The kind of conspiracy theories that psychologists have become particularly interested in, we can go there, if you like, for an operational definition. So we're saying that really this is what we mean when we're talking about a conspiracy theory. We're talking about a sinister plot by extremely powerful individuals that's being hidden from the rest of us so that they can benefit either by kind of world takeover or achieving their genocidal aims or whatever else it may be. But basically, it's going to be to our detriment and to their benefit, and it's going on behind the scenes. It's being hidden. It's often based on very kind of flimsy evidence. And as I say, in terms of our operational definition, it would be an idea that's actually unproven. It's an idea that's being pushed, but if we got to the point where it was proven, it would stop being a conspiracy theory and it would become an established conspiracy.
That's a little bit different from the paranormal activity that you started with, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Which doesn't
it is.
Require any kind of conspiracy. What's the connection there?
As I say, the connection for me is that I just have a more general interest in the psychology of what I see as being kind of very weird and extreme beliefs. Now, of course, a point you were making earlier is that, you know, some conspiracies really do take place. And so we're not in a position where we're saying, oh, no conspiracy has ever happened. Of course they do. And there are powerful people and they are plotting for their own ends behind the scenes. At the level of a kind of global takeover and this kind of thing, that's where things kind of get really interesting. And I would certainly argue that those kinds of claims are not substantiated. But really, it's that more general interest in the psychology of weird stuff.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about conspiracy thinking with Christopher French from the University of London.
Do you believe any conspiracy theories? Or do you think they're all totally irrational? What makes someone believe a conspiracy theory in the first place?
Truth, lies, and conspiracies. Along with your comments and questions, When Philosophy Talk continues.
There's a big conspiracy.
What is it like to put on that tinfoil hat and see conspiracies everywhere? I'm Ray Briggs. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Blakey Vermeul, sitting in for Josh Landy, and we're thinking like a conspiracy theorist with Christopher French from the University of London, co-author of Anomalistic Psychology.
Got questions about why people love conspiracy theories? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
Chris, we've got a lot of listener questions for today's episode, so we're going to dig right in right away with those. Wendy in San Francisco asks, I've noticed that my friends who tend to believe conspiracy theories, they're 9/11 truthers or COVID deniers, etc., also believe that they are smarter than everyone else. They like clues dropped. This is the appeal of QAnon that engage them in the process of figuring it out. What do you think about that?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, there's good evidence to support the idea that one of the factors, and it is only one out of a whole multitude of factors, but one of the factors that attracts people to conspiracy theorists is that sense of superiority, that sense that you see the way the world really is, not like the sheeple around you. A lot of conspiracy theorists take the view that if you don't actually accept the conspiracies that they're putting forward, you have one of two choices. You're either sheeple, you've been taken in by the conspirators, or you are part of the conspiracy yourself. I often get accused of being part of conspiracies, and if that's the case, I wish the government would send me the money because it doesn't seem to be coming through.
So, Chris, you said that one of the factors in believing conspiracy Is this thinking you're smarter than everybody else? What are some of the other ones?
There's a whole host of factors. It's interesting that up until probably about 15 years ago, there's very little psychological research in this area, but it has become an incredibly hot topic. Amongst the kind of cognitive biases, which seem to be the most important, there are a number that have been looked at. I mean, one of the reasons we're so successful as a species is because we are very good at making sense of what's going around us, of finding patterns, of observing things, and sometimes we think we see a significant pattern there. And that's obviously been incredibly useful, but sometimes we overplay that. We think we see meaning when in fact there's just randomness. We make connections that aren't actually really there. And that is a very important factor with respect to conspiracism, conspiracy-type thinking. Other factors are something called the intentionality bias, the idea that things don't happen by accident. When things happen in the world around you, sometimes they happen because someone made them happen with some intention in mind, but sometimes things just happen, you know, out of the blue randomly. But conspiracy theorists tend to have a much greater bias towards believing that things do not happen by accident. So, again, they're reading the meaning in that they think must be there. There's also what's called a proportionality bias. The idea that when big, important world events happen, they can't have small causes. They have to have big causes because they're big events. So the idea that Diane's car crashed in a tunnel in Paris because her driver was a little bit tipsy, that's not a big enough reason. There must be something more going on there. There must be some conspiracy behind it. She must have been assassinated, etc.
Yeah, so these all sound like biases that like everybody is susceptible to some degree. Is there something special that pushes people over into believing conspiracy theories that involves them having more of these biases than everybody else? Like, how does that happen?
Well, again, there's, as I say, there's a whole host of different factors that come into play. Not only these inherent biases that we all have, but also there can be certain kinds of personality factors. So, I mean, an obvious one, which won't surprise anybody, is that you tend to score higher in terms of paranoia if you are more inclined to believe in conspiracy theories. But also, if you like, on a more positive note, people who believe in conspiracy theories show a greater openness to new ideas. And it might be because they were attracted to those unusual ideas in the first place and actually spent time reading about them that they end up going down the rabbit hole. Also, people who feel powerless, people who feel like outsiders. And again, I think this gets back to the first point we were making. One possible motivation here is if you feel that life is not all it should be for you personally, well, maybe there's someone or some group to actually blame for that. And again, lots of conspiracy theorists involve putting the blame on the Jews, the Illuminati, immigrants, whoever. But you have an out-group and an in-group. And within that in-group, you can achieve quite a lot of status the more you buy into the conspiracies. And QAnon is a kind of, if you like, a participatory conspiracy theory where people are actively involved in trying to sort what they see as being these cryptic clues that are being fed to them and so on. So, you know, there's the social aspect as well. There's an awful lot going on here. But if you find yourself in the appropriate set of circumstances, then, you know, there is always a risk that people can go down that rabbit hole.
Could we dig into that a little bit more, Chris? I am very interested in how groups of politically like-minded people attribute conspiracy thinking to people who don't think like them. This is, mm-hmm. We're in a state of incredible political polarization at the moment, and it's true across the political spectrum. So liberal Democrats tend to think that Trump voters are riddled by conspiracy thinking, whereas conservatives tend to think that liberals are completely captured by a certain set of media biases. Do you have a way to help us think about that?
I think, again, it's certainly true what you're saying. I mean, one of the leading researchers in this area is a friend of mine called Joe Yusinski, who is an American political scientist, and he's written about this extensively, this partisanship that comes in. And I think, personally, it's one of those things that I think we can all see it in our own thinking. I mean, I'm a typical kind of academic with a bias towards the kind of left-wing views. And so I find it much easier to buy into the idea that President Trump may have colluded with the Russians to achieve the election result that he achieved a few years back. And, you know, it turns out that there isn't actually any direct evidence for that. But I find it much easier to believe that than some of the kind of what I see as nonsense put out by the extreme right. And I think that's, again, just this. We all have a bias that probably the single most pervasive and powerful cognitive bias that we all suffer from is confirmation bias. We are more inclined to accept evidence that supports what we either already believe to be true or what we'd like to be true. For a start, we'll seek more of that evidence, so we're actively seeking it and taking it in, but we'll also have reasons for ignoring or playing down any evidence that seems to count against us. And of course, this is what the conspiracy theorists do as well, but we all do it. We need to be aware that we've all got these biases. And it's basically an attempt to try and have what to our minds is a kind of coherent and consistent way of view of the way the world works. It's trying to make sense of the world around us. One of the problems with conspiracy theories is that, to quote a friend of mine, a philosopher, Stephen Law, he talks about intellectual black holes. There are certain belief systems that once you get into them, it's very difficult to get out, in the same way that light can't escape from a black hole. And conspiracy theories are a kind of prime example of this, because any evidence that appears to count against your conspiracy, no matter how strong, well, the argument is it was put there by the conspirators. You can ignore it. You don't need to take it seriously. And any evidence that supports your view, no matter how weak and flimsy, well, that's the evidence you'll pay attention to.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about conspiracy theories with Christopher French from the University of London. So we've got a comment from Mel in Central California. Mel writes, "Conspiracy theories are awesome. I love digging in to see how quickly one of the several common flaws will pop up. Will it be the lacking motive problem, the too many people required to stay quiet to be plausible problem, etc.? Conspiracy theories are important for their ability to sharpen our critical thinking." So, Chris, what do you think? Are conspiracy theories good for sharpening our critical thinking?
I certainly think that they can be. I mean, they have a certain kind of inherent fascination. I mean, we can see this by the very fact that they're so often the subject of dramas. I mean, typically in any kind of fictional account, it turns out that the conspiracy theorist who everybody viewed as being crazy is correct. They turn out to be the hero. In real life, it tends not to go that way. But yeah, they've got a kind of an inherent fascination, so they get people interested. I mean, I'm again one of those kind of people who is fascinated by these weird theories and these weird ideas. You know, you look at the kind of satanic panic back in the 80s, which seems to have been incorporated into the QAnon conspiracies these days. And it's kind of taking your imagination maybe to places you don't really want to go, but there is something inherently kind of fascinating and entertaining. And then trying to work out, as I said, that comment there was great, that, you know, where does the kind of the flaws in the thinking kind of show through at what point? And of course, with conspiracy theorizing, typically you have to involve more and more people in the conspiracy for it to possibly be kept secret. And that becomes just unmanageable, because we know in real life that it's actually very, very difficult to maintain that level of secrecy amongst all those people.
We have a question from Arthur in Washington, D.C. And the question is there some kind of analogy or resonance between complicated, multivalent conspiracy theories and the kind of deeply immersive video games that are now on the market, where you navigate and or create a world and have to do your own research to figure out how to play the game? We seem to be psychologically and philosophically inclined towards this kind of immersive game playing, and we find it fun. And we like that there's some causal logic behind the game. Do people bring this idea, this sort of gamification of the world into the world to satisfy some of the same urges, do you think?
That's a really interesting thought. It's not something I'd ever thought about before, I have to confess. But I can see where that argument is coming from. The idea that there is this complex intellectual challenge. And I think maybe this is, again, why QAnon has kind of taken hold in those people who follow it, because certainly there we have got this notion of kind of layers upon layers and trying to crack the codes and trying to figure out what the clues mean. And certainly, you know, for those people who are involved, I think it becomes almost kind of addictive, and they get a great deal of pleasure out of putting forward some new explanation that might be then kind of go viral amongst the other followers of QAnon and so on. So that's a really interesting suggestion.
Yeah, I feel like this puzzle about where conspiracy theories come from is really compelling. And we got actually some other questions about that. So Harriet in San Diego asks, why is it that in the U.S. right now, conspiracy theories have run amok and are driving politics? What is it about the style of politics that leads to people being distrustful of formal institutions, experts, and official narratives, and a belief that a cabal of powerful people are conspiring to further their own ends at their expense?
Well, again, I mean, we can look back and quite easily identify some very powerful voices, including a former president of the United States, who really embraced these ideas and pushed them, sometimes subtly, sometimes not so subtly, amongst his followers. I think one of the things that I find kind of most concerning is this notion that we now live in a post-fact world where the actual truth or falsity of what is being claimed, what is being said, matters less than who said it, and are they one of us, and does it make me feel good? Does it fit into my worldview? I kind of find that very, very worrying. But I think the main point I want to make there is that these conspiracy theories have always been around for centuries and centuries. You know, we find that, I mean, a lot of the QAnon stuff, it's just incorporated previously existing ideas that had been knocking around, including, as I mentioned earlier, the satanic panic and so on and so forth, and just kind of repackaged them and kind of put them out there. But that these ideas have always been around, and I suspect they always will be, because I think they are based upon the kind of biases that we have as a result of our evolutionary history.
So I'm curious about this idea that people don't always totally believe conspiracy theories, but might buy into parts of them. Like, how should I think about that? Like, should I be worried about the damaging effects of buying into part of a conspiracy theory, even if the person doesn't completely sort of buy it whole hog?
I mean, again, this whole notion of, well, just how dangerous are conspiracy theories is a fascinating one, because on the one hand, you know, if your next door neighbour believes that the moon landings were faked, well, so what? You know, on its own, it doesn't really matter that much, does it? One of the problems is that we know that one of the biggest predictors of whether you believe in conspiracy theory X is, do you believe in conspiracy theory Y, even when they are totally unrelated. So the fact that your neighbour thinks that the moon landings were faked means your neighbour is also more likely to believe other conspiracies. And some of those other conspiracies may actually be dangerous. So, I mean, obviously, the prime examples of dangerous conspiracy theories, not only for the person who believes them, but for wider society, are the anti-vax movement, people who believe that climate change is a hoax, and therefore they don't need to kind of engage in any kind of steps to try and protect the environment. You know, a lot of other kind of medical conspiracies, but some of them, obviously, as we heard in the introduction there, some of them are true. Some of them did turn out. So you do, you know, you always have to be careful. And it's not easy. You have to learn to live with uncertainty. We're not comfortable with uncertainty. I mean, there will be situations where I might in the past have rejected something as being too conspiratorial that turned out to be true. But most, the 99% of what I reject as being too conspiratorial, I'm pretty sure actually is.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking like a conspiracy theorist with Christopher French from the University of London, co-author of Anomalistic Psychology.
Why do people have such disparate views of reality? Is disinformation on the internet to blame? Should we teach more critical thinking in schools?
Combating conspiracy thinking. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. What makes someone think that whatever's out there must be the product of unseen forces? I'm Ray Briggs, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Blakey Vermeule, sitting in for Josh Landy, and we're thinking like a conspiracy theorist with Chris French from the University of London.
So, Chris, it seems like conspiracy thinking is on the rise. Give us your most important tool for combating the kinds of cognitive biases that make us more susceptible to this thinking.
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd have to say is that not everybody believes that conspiracy thinking is on the rise. If you look at opinion poll data, you'll find that, yeah, there's some fluctuations depending upon what's topical and so on, or even who's in power at the time. But overall, those kind of levels stay about the same from one decade to another, which is quite surprising. It's something that quite surprised me when this was first drawn to my attention, but it does actually appear to be the case. Having said that, I think it's true to say and fair to say that conspiracy type ideas have entered the mainstream in a way that we haven't had before. So we're all more aware of them, including, you know, the media. There are a lot more articles about them and so on and so forth. Now, in terms of trying to combat them, I think the most important thing to try and do would be to give people critical thinking skills to the extent that it's possible to do that. It's not really a matter of telling people what to think. It's more trying to help them, you know, tell them how to think, in terms of pointing out the kind of errors that we're all prone to, we're all susceptible to. And even knowing about them isn't enough on its own to prevent them having an effect. They still will, but they'll maybe have less of an effect. And so critical thinking at an early age, teaching those kind of skills is one way forward. There are other aspects as well. I mean, there's the idea of trying to what's called pre-bunking, where you warn people about a particular conspiracy theory and why it's not true, maybe before they've even been exposed to it. But if they have been exposed to it, then debunking actually can be quite effective. There was a bit of a worry in the kind of academic world at one point that maybe debunking sometimes backfires. And there was literally something referred to as the backfire effect, where when you try to debunk a false claim, it kind of has a short-term effect, but then later on people remember the claim but forget the debunking. Now, it turns out our worries over that seem to have been a bit exaggerated, and debunking can work if it's done well.
So I saw a very funny thing on the internet called Prospiracy Theories, which basically took the line, you know, people are trying to get you to believe that the earth is flat and everybody's covering it up. Don't trust them. And so, like, painting conspiracy theories as themselves conspiracies. I think it was a joke. Is there any value to that as a serious tool, or is it just sort of a joke?
Well, I mean, do you mean using humor to try to... I think using humor to try to combat conspiracy theories can actually be sometimes more effective than 1,001 syllogisms. You know, it's one of those situations. There are a couple of comedians in this country, Mitchell and Webb, David Mitchell and Robert Webb, and they've got a couple of sketches on conspiracy theories where they start off with these three people in obviously a secret bunker plotting various conspiracies, and just by treating it with such humour you realise the absurdity of what's actually being suggested in a way that maybe doesn't come across if you read a dry academic paper. So I think that can be effective, but also, I mean, I think it is important to not come across as laughing at the silly people who believe the conspiracy theories. They've got their own reasons for those kinds of beliefs. And if someone, you know, believes something really passionately and strongly, try and respect them, try to understand where they're coming from, and try to just say, well, have you thought that maybe this is what's really going on, or this is an alternative explanation? But it's difficult, it's not easy. And I think that really we ought to aim our efforts not at the kind of extreme believers, because we will never ever pull them out of the intellectual black hole, but it's the people who've maybe heard that, oh, is it the case that kind of, you know, vaccinations can cause autism, is that true, you know? And you can then try and say, well, no, actually there've been lots of studies that show this, and there's no evidence for that at all, and try and prevent that person from going further down the rabbit hole.
Maybe we could use me as an example of somebody who needs to be talked down from her conspiracy theory, and you can show me how you would do that. So I have become a bit of a climate doomer, and I think that there's a conspiracy of silence in the, let's say, the fossil fuel captured media to kind of keep the bad news off the front page. I mean, but when I say that to my friends, they think I'm, you know, a little nuts and a little paranoid, and they use my fear of being a conspiracy theorist against me. And I'm wondering if you can help me think through how to go from here.
Yeah, that was a particularly bad example you've chosen there, because I think you're probably right. So, I mean, again, it raises an interesting issue of what do we call a conspiracy theory? I mean, why is it that the media, I don't think the media is paying anywhere near enough attention to the climate crisis. You know, according to all the best evidence, we've got to sort things out literally within the next few years, or we're going to get to a point of no return. So why isn't this being headline news every single day until governments take appropriate action? But I don't think that's necessarily a conspiracy. If most of the mainstream media kind of don't really fully recognize yet the urgency of that situation, then it's not going to appear on the front pages. But there's nobody, I mean, I think we can point to big oil, and I would say there's clear evidence that they, as the tobacco industry did years ago, they were deliberately muddying the water, putting out kind of misinformation, disinformation, and the fossil fuel industry seems to be doing exactly the same with greenwashing, with, you know, basically taking very little action while they're pretending to take action. So just because it's been labelled as a conspiracy theory doesn't necessarily mean it's not true. And I think in this case, I would say that the kind of there is a definite media bias against reporting news that should be getting a lot more attention.
Yeah, so this kind of brings us back to the difference between like conspiracy theory and just documented conspiracy. I like Blakey's climate example because I do think it's kind of a documented conspiracy, or like, I don't know, maybe you need to be a bit more nefarious and have less buy-in from everybody to be a conspiracy. But like, surely there's in-between territory where a theory is getting established. How do I understand, like, when does something go from being a conspiracy theory being a conspiracy?
That is an excellent question, and one which I should have expected from a philosopher. Yeah, I mean, if you take something like, let's take some of the kind of famous established conspiracies, something like kind of the Watergate scandal or whatever. I mean, obviously, once you get to a point where the people involved are confessing that there was a conspiracy, I think we could probably all accept then, unless we think they've been pressured or brainwashed into kind of making those statements, that would be enough for most people. I mean, even then, it's a blurry line. It's a blurry line, but we can all accept that there are some conspiracies that have been established beyond all reasonable doubt. There are others that may be true or may not be true. We might want to withhold judgment on, and that's where that kind of uncertainty that we're not really very fond of comes in. There are others which we feel just, you know, I mean, you may just call this prejudice, but the idea that the world is being run by shape-shifting lizards, I don't feel that I even need to kind of look in any depth at the evidence there. I just think it's too far-fetched to begin with. But I, you know, even there, potentially, I could be wrong.
I have a question from Fanny in Oakland, who also wants to know about the difference between conspiracy theory and conspiracy fact. Fanny writes, a large part of the problem is that the media give them all legitimacy by referring to them as conspiracy theories. Theories, writes Fanny, are subject to verification or rejection by evidence. And she says most of the things referred to as conspiracy theories are essentially faith-based religious beliefs with evidence categorically rejected. So that sounds like a kind of the opposite of what we were suggesting, which is that there's this continuum.
I think there's a kind of interesting point being made. There's some interesting points being made. But I mean, typically the term conspiracy theorist or conspiracy theory, there are terms that are used pejoratively. You know, we don't, if you call someone a conspiracy theorist, it's very, very rarely going to be a compliment. So I think that when the mainstream media kind of refer to conspiracy theories, typically they are not kind of saying, I don't think they are giving them any greater legitimacy. If they talk about conspiracies, then that's a different matter. Conspiracies implies this is something that has been, you know, established to be the case. I mean, in scientific terms, you know, a theory has a kind of particular meaning in terms of what Fanny was talking about there, and I'd agree with her on that. For certainly in lay usage, I mean, just the very expression, oh, it's just a theory, that is used to kind of say, oh, that's something that's not been established yet, it's not been proven. So I think we need to kind of be careful just about the way that people are using words. I mean, and of course, conspiracy and conspiracy theories themselves are kind of very slippery concepts.
So if you have one piece of advice for people talking to their relatives about conspiracy theories, what would you suggest?
It's a very good question. I think really I would say, and again, this is something that a conspiracy theorist would blow out of the water instantly. I would say, look at the sources that the information is coming from. Are they kind of reputable, established sources that you generally would trust? Or is this just an idea that seems to have kind of come from nowhere, that's been pushed by somebody who doesn't really have any evidence to support it? So if you have a situation where a claim is coming from, say, an established university, if it's a peer-reviewed paper, etc., it is probably going to be more trustworthy than somebody who has just, quote, done their own research on the internet.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Our guest has been Christopher French, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of London and author of Anomalistic Psychology, Exploring Paranormal Belief and Experience. And thank you, Blake, for guest hosting again.
My pleasure. We'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now, a man so fast, they have tried to cover it up. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, moments of doubt, half-whispered rumors, blatant propaganda, things we wish were true or are afraid are true, all codified, unverified, but normalized. And before you know it, we've accrued all sorts of notions, some fantastic, some practical, survival tips, how to cook tilapia in a bunker, and now we're locked into our dreary scrapbooks, layouts of Dealey Plaza, blurry photographs of the Gulf of Tonkin, Yellow Cape uranium forgeries. We got piles, we got tons, we never get tired of it. Conspiracies are true and not true at the same time. It doesn't matter. They get us out of the house and into wars. That's the important thing. Conspiracies give you that all-important leeway in your personal beliefs, any uncertainty tempered by belligerent insistence. America loves a good confidence man, and we remain willing suckers to any slicker with a line of patter. Do the research is the internet's cry, often posted by a guy about to blow his life savings on a magic coin that only exists on the internet. Not just America. The whole world is a sucker. Centuries ago, we were all certain, not certain, that there was a superhuman wizard priest king called Prester John. And he had a kingdom somehow squeezed in between India and China. A letter from him asked the Europeans to send armies to help defend his land of milk and honey, presently being besieged by various pagans. This letter, I must say, was not authentic. Yet, one of the reasons Columbus set sail was to find this hidden kingdom. We never found it, but we're no stranger to other lands we've never seen. Courtesy of religion, myth, plain old cock and bull. We have Atlantis, Troy, heaven and hell, never verified, yet we know so much. We also have fairyland and UFOs, which might come from fairyland. We don't know. We have Odin and Zeus and their Olympian and Asgardian baggage. We have exotic visions of the future in movies like Westworld, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Mad Max, Blade Runner. Horrible places, really. Why even go there? What do we care? We'll be dead by the time the Trump clones are ready to rule.
Now, right now, the main paranoid fantasy seems to be a reaction to the conspiracy theory that liberals are communists, hell-bent on bringing Chinese orphans over the Mexican border to addict us to fentanyl and replace your uncle at the pipe-fitting job with solar-powered robots. That's a lot to hold in the brain. To fight this conspiracy, we need to bring this country back to its former glory, which it actually, spoiler alert, never had. We seem to be taking our cues from Disneyland before it got woke. The America of Davy Crockett and steam trains and big old gabled houses with a lovable Irish cook named Flossie. Swimming pools, movie stars. It's a hodgepodge of up-with-people history, spectacle sports, and church barbecues without the church part. This throwback world lies just beyond our ken, with no messenger god, no Mercury or Papa Legba figure to bring us from here to there, this world to that. Again, all we have is Trump. Like a poor man's rapture, only it's all end time, all the time. But strangely, since this is a dream of our own making, we're not really involved in the process. Trump will return with his army of do-gooders or make-things-righters, which includes JFK Jr. back from the dead. Also, maybe Robin Williams, Dale Earnhardt, Michael Jackson. They've all been seen. They'll be rounding up pedophile libtards for prison or execution. QAnon calls this the storm. But the rest of us will be just watching, eating popcorn for some reason, like it's halftime at the Super Bowl. Now, that may be the secret sauce to this paranoid fantasy. It's quite exciting, but it's not happening to us. We're just watching. And just like that, we are no longer citizens. We're consumers. And I think that would be just fine for a lot of us. Just give us a hotline where you can complain about how management is running things. And another hotline where you can complain and shame the complainers. It's kind of like Twitter. We'll be fine. The conspiracies cancel each other out. Who needs democracy? Send in the clowns. Oh, wait. Don't bother. They're here. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2022.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Yi-Chi Shi, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Max, you...
Stop calling me Max.
Why, Max? It's a good name for you. Max, you see conspiracies in everything.